are cloudy and gray. They're only gray for a day. So wrap your troubles in dreams and dream your troubles away.
Almost 10 years ago, I spent Christmas 2005 in New Orleans. Large parts of the city were still dark after Katrina. Houses were marked with spray paint from first responders, shorthand for who had lived and who had died. A school teacher told me material gifts just didn't matter that year. He said, "It's not about a dollar." I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. But of course, rebuilding after a disaster is in part about a dollar. It can take a lot of money to get a city back on its feet. And Katrina shaped New Orleans and the Gulf Coast economies in ways we couldn't even imagine on that night. So this hour, we're exploring the impact that the storm had 10 years after it made landfall, in individual lives and businesses, in culture, and in how we respond to disasters. You can share your thoughts and memories of the storm with us at marketplaceweekend.org. on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're going to take you around New Orleans today through the story of one small business, Confederacy of Cruisers Bike Tours. After Katrina hit in 2005, Jeff Scheinman and Leisha Ferguson quit their hospitality jobs in New Orleans and went to Peru without any real plan for the future. They'd planned to go on a tour to see wild condors. Instead, they wound up in the middle of political and social unrest, burning tires and demonstrations, and their tour guide gave them context and explanation. That experience inspired them to start a business back in New Orleans, a bike tour company to take visitors around the city and its neighborhoods while explaining the complicated recovery after Katrina, with the same kind of rich context they got in Peru. They started with 5 bikes in their living room. The company has since grown to 52 bikes, 7 tour guides, and Jeff and Leisha work there full time.
And we are at the brain quarters of Confederacy of Cruisers Bike Tours.
We really wanted to be able to show people New Orleans and that New Orleans had culture behind just, I guess, the boobs and the beads that most people think of as New Orleans.
As a New Orleanian, that's what was interesting, the people of the city. Leisha, my partner, is now my business partner. She was my relationship partner. We're still holding together as a business, if not as a relationship.
We also own a house together. He lives on one side of the house. I live on the other.
It's not as sitcom as it sounds in that New Orleans houses are duplexes. Everybody has their 12 and a half feet and then a wall and the other 12 and a half feet. So there is a wall between us.
We need our separation. I had run the numbers and I was like, okay, if we want to have a decent life, we need to take out 32 people a week. And Jeff said, no way, it'll never happen. There's not a chance. This is not even feasible. You're going to have to go back to work. And I was like, no, I think it's going to be good. We're going to be fine. We only started with probably about $2,500 worth of investment, schooling, bicycles. Over the time, the bicycle inventory grew. Our living room was now not 5 bikes, but then 16 bikes, and then 20 bikes, and then 30 bikes.
And in terms of guides, probably about 5. And everybody that we're friends with.
We have 7 guides.
Now, as 10 years have gone by, now these neighborhoods, the same ones that we were the first bringing people into, they are written about, the New York Times articles. People are told they really need to go to. But when we started, they were neighborhoods that nobody heard of. And the people who lived there, it really gave them joy. It really made me happy.
That's right. I mean, we were kind of one of the first tour companies to take people outside of the French Quarter Garden District or Swamp Tour.
One of my favorite things is somebody had asked at the end of the tour, and this only once in 9 years, he was like, I don't get the tour. We didn't really see anything. Where were the sites? And the neighborhood is the sites. The people are the sites. There are no sites except everything we see. And that's kind of what we like to give.
How the different people have come in, but their quirkiness has kept and driven this the feeling of the neighborhoods today.
We'll hear more from Jeff and Leisha throughout the show. In the 10 years since Katrina, New Orleans and the Gulf Coast had been reshaped in many ways. who lives there, the kind of work they do, what they can afford. And being Marketplace, we wanted to do the numbers on New Orleans. To do that, we've got Allison Plyer, the executive director of the Data Center, a New Orleans-based think tank. They've been publishing the New Orleans Index for the past decade. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
To do the numbers on New Orleans now, you're kind of the person, so I'd like you to just first off lay out for me, who is living in New Orleans 10 years after the storm, and what kind of fluctuations have we seen?
Well, the city has about 384,000 people there now, and pre-Katrina, according to Census 2000, we had about 484, so about 100,000 less. But every year we gain population, so I always remind folks that's the most important thing. As long as every year it's going up, that's good. The demographics have changed. Pre-Katrina, about 66% of the population was African-American. We've lost about 97,000 African-American residents, which was a large chunk, and so now we're just about 59% African-American. We also lost about 9,000 white residents. A lot of folks don't realize that. But still, proportionately, now the city has, you know, a larger share of whites just because the African-American population has declined so much. And we've also gained Hispanics. So we've gained about 6,000 Hispanics and a couple thousand Asians. So more diverse in a different kind of way than we were pre-Katrina. We also talk about the whole region, though, because, you know, really the whole region was affected. A couple of the other parishes were more damaged than New Orleans itself.
Yeah, St. Bernard Parish, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Completely destroyed. Exactly. And Plaquemines was really devastated. And Jefferson had a lot of flooding. So what's interesting when you look at the whole region is that the population has sort of shifted east and north and away from St. Bernard and Plaquemines. And so, and the whole region has become more diverse.
When you look at the public services that the city offers, some of the biggest questions you guys raised were about things like public transit. And then there are sort of other things that are quasi-public goods, you know, healthcare, hospitals, things like grocery stores. Paint a picture for me now of what the city looks like on those measures.
We used to have a pretty good system of buses relative to many other cities in the country, certainly not relative to New York or San Francisco, but relative to other cities, we had a pretty good system of buses. And those buses were flooded, as I think everybody saw.
Yeah.
And the reimbursement from FEMA was such that we only were able to acquire about a fifth of the buses that we had pre-Katrina. So that means we have a lot fewer routes running right now and a lot less frequency. And that's really hard for a lot of our workers who work in the tourism industry and rely on that. Healthcare, actually, there's been a movement toward community-based clinics that spawned really out of Katrina and has been more effective in supplying primary healthcare than our previous model, which was all centralized downtown in the charity
hospital. Yeah,
it delivered a lot of other care really, really well. But for primary care, this decentralized system of clinics has proven to give more access to low income communities to the primary care, and we're seeing that now in the studies that are coming out. Grocery stores have rebounded to pre-Katrina levels. Tulane just came out with a study on that, and the pre-Katrina levels were not as good as they should be. We still have food deserts, but there was a time when it was really dire here in terms of the availability of grocery stores. And then there's the schools, right?
Right.
And they're all over the city, in a variety of places. They're all charters, virtually all charters now, and with citywide access for every single one of them.
New Orleans will be 300 years old in 3 years. And I know 3 years is not a lot of time, but I'm curious, what are the numbers that you would like to see change between now and 2018?
Well, I think what's really hit home here in New Orleans is that as hard as we have worked to transform our institutions, to improve our public schools, to reduce our corruption, reduce our incarceration rates, we still, and I should say improve our economy, which we have done, we still see these glaring disparities. The city is measured as having the second worst income disparity in the nation after
Wow.
Atlanta. And that's really just gotten worse in the last few years. So despite all of these successes, we see that we are not yet the city that we want to be. And there's a lot of effort now, led particularly by the mayor, to improve employment rates, especially among African-American men. That's a hard thing to do in a city that for three decades had a declining economy and neighborhoods where folks had so little access to jobs. And now a generation of folks who didn't know about good job opportunities.
Allison Plyer, Executive Director and Chief Demographer at the Data Center in New Orleans, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
We'll take a deeper look at the employment situation in New Orleans later in the show. We introduced you to Jeff Scheinman and Leisha Ferguson at the top of the show. They took our producer Jenny Ament around New Orleans, showing her the city and the small business they built after Katrina. You'll hear them throughout the hour. Our first stop, the Mississippi River.
We're about to go over what we call the Rusty Rainbow and over to the Mississippi River.
And just to show you, just a great visual for those who are not looking at this at home, if you look on over to that side, you're seeing the Mississippi River. The river is really high right now. Look on over to the neighborhood, and you could actually tell that the river is at a higher altitude than the neighborhood right next to it. Just gives you an idea of what the city is always dealing with historically and in the future.
It's a beautiful sight, though. It's a nice sunny day, blue skies. And there's a big barge pushing down the river. I guess if we look to our right, we can see the Central Business District and the tip of Algier Point, with now a big Carnival cruise ship boat over there. Should we move on?
So we're just going to jump on our bicycles and head on.
We're focused on New Orleans and its people today and how they're faring 10 years after Katrina. We're going to look at just a few of a lot of the big numbers that grew out of the storm. Here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with a special installment of By the Numbers. Tobin?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
250,000.
That's how many pets were left behind when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans.
And about 150,000 pets died as a result of the hurricane and its aftermath.
Following public outcry, plans for evacuating animals out of disaster situations were adopted the next year.
8.5 years.
That's how long it took the beloved Circle Food Store to reopen its doors after Katrina. For many small businesses in New Orleans, the damage from the floods was devastating.
Brooke Boudreau, director of marketing at Circle Food, says the store was in such poor shape, it wasn't so much a question of if they would reopen, but if there was even a store to come back to.
10.
That's how many cities,
New Orleans included,
have been picked by President Obama for a program with AmeriCorps focused on strengthening low-income communities.
Of the big goals, help develop plans for dealing with extreme weather.
That song you just heard is Hurricane Season by New Orleans musician Trombone Shorty and his band Orleans Avenue. His real name is Troy Andrews, and he started performing as a child growing up in the Tremé neighborhood. Now he's one of the city's musical luminaries. He also started a foundation to teach young musicians and to teach them how to make a living in the music business. Troy Andrews took us for a walk through Tremé.
Well, where I'm standing is on the corner of Dumaine and Villery, North Villery in New Orleans, and I'm actually staring at the house that I grew up in, and that's where I learned how to play music and all the neighborhood and all the family and all my friends, and I just have a lot of memories of us walking around carrying boxes and just making instruments on this street. So this is really my roots in the beginning, and also it's right on the outside of Louis Armstrong Park, so there's a lot of history here.
What's Tremé like now, 10 years after the storm? What do you think has changed?
Well, I'm looking around, and from 10 years ago, I don't see anyone really on the street. We have a lot of people in the neighborhood that doesn't even know the history of the neighborhood, doesn't know what it's about. And 10 years ago, if we were here, we probably wouldn't be able to do this interview because we would have second line parades going around with Reedbird Brass Band or my family band, and it would just be all music all day. So it's definitely a different spot, and it's sad to see it just really silent like this.
You know, I looked at home prices in Treme, and I noticed that over the past couple of years, they've jumped like $18,000, $20,000. Do you think that's changed kind of who can live in Treme?
I got a lot of family and that used to stay here in the Treme. My grandmother still has a little house. She used to stay here in the Treme. But definitely that price range have put a lot of people out of the range of being able to live here, because before the storm, they knew that they can make their rent off of their jobs that they were doing. And now with that happening, you have a lot of people, original Treme people that I grew up with, they can't afford to live here anymore in this particular part of Treme.
I think about the last 10 years and your career as well. You know, in 2005, you were playing with Lenny Kravitz. You had a really good couple of years in those early years of the 2000s. For you, what's changed in the past 10 years? I mean, you're the guy now. You're the marquee name.
Well, I don't know if I want to take that much pressure on, but only thing I ever wanted to do was just play music, and my passion for music is so strong that it's been my passport. I just never forgot what my focus was, and that was to become and still become one of the best musicians that I can become. And I think being able to play with people like Lenny, and that just opened the doors for a lot more people to hear the New Orleans sound come out of my horn and how much passion it is. So I didn't have any plan on being where I am now. I didn't have a marketing strategy. I didn't have nothing. I just continued to play and believe in the music of New Orleans, and it took me where I am now.
Have you seen musicians go broke, fail because they didn't know how to make the business side work?
Yeah, I've seen musicians that had great potential to make some money, and I've seen musicians my whole life here that's used to making a certain amount of money that, and now that they're older, it's a bit harder for them. So I don't know if I actually seen someone go broke more than I actually seen someone not take the full potential of where they can be.
Hmm. What do you think is important for young people who, say, go to your academy to learn now? Because this is a very different New Orleans now than when you were coming up and starting to play. So what do they need to learn to understand the musical history of where you are?
As I stand in Treme, one of the reasons why I created the foundation is because I had people like Kermit Ruffins, my family, the Rebirth Brass Band lived around the corner, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, and all these people were my teachers, and they would pass by my house in the middle of their tour. They would give me an assignment, and I would learn it, and when they get back in a couple of months, they expect me to be able to play it. And I just had so much love like that, and that's why I wanted to create that, because that doesn't exist anymore in New Orleans for us to have neighborhood superstars like Dirty Dozen, the Tuba Fats, the late the Treme Brass Band to come and help. So I wanted to be able to reach citywide and have all those kids come and be able to be in a different environment than I was playing on the street with some of the great musicians. And I wanted to expose those kids to the lineage of our music and the history. In order for them to be where they want to go and to take this thing to another level, they must understand the history and at least have some knowledge about how it was created and how I at least got to my sound. And they can go from there.
Troy Andrews, Trombone Shorty, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
When you talk to pretty much anyone along the Louisiana coast about rebuilding after Katrina, they say it almost doesn't matter unless the area can be protected from another storm. And like many things, that is a matter of money. The state legislature came up with a $50 billion plan for coastal restoration, doing things like restoring the wetlands that act as a natural storm barrier. Mark Schlefstein is here to talk about the project and its price tag. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner who's covered the environment and hurricanes for 30 years for NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. He also famously predicted what a storm like Katrina could do to the city back in 2002. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for asking.
You have written about, in fact, you know what, I'm going to actually just start with the headline here because I think it's pretty interesting. New Orleans' future depends on coastal restoration, but where's the money? So we're going to start with that topic, but I guess before we ask where the money is, can you explain what the master plan is for people who are not steeped in the Louisiana coast as you are?
Sure. After Hurricane Katrina, Congress told the Army Corps of Engineers to take a look at what the potential was for protecting the Louisiana coastline from both hurricanes larger than the same size as Katrina and larger, and also putting in some coastal restoration features as part of that. The Corps did that, but the state was very concerned about what would happen, and so it came up with its own master plan, and it's ended up that that actually is the plan that the Corps is allowing to be adopted. And so the state has this plan. It was adopted by the state legislature in 2007 and updated in 2012. And it calls for spending $50 billion over 50 years, half and half for coastal restoration and for improvements to levees all along Louisiana's coast, including the New Orleans area.
And about how much money do they have right now? And where does it come from?
Well, there's a variety of different places where they're looking for money and hope to get money. The most recent good news in a bad situation was that the state is one of the states along the Gulf Coast that is participating in a settlement with BP over Clean Water Act and natural resource damage claims. And a significant chunk of that money will end up going to coastal restoration, well over maybe as much as $8 to $8.5 billion when it's all completed.
I went back and was reading some of your very famous coverage when you essentially predicted what Katrina would do to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And there's a line here that says, scientists say cities and towns will become man-made islands surrounded by rising Gulf waters and vulnerable to all manner of storms. That was in 2002. Then we saw what Katrina did. Louisiana loses a football field of land every 30 minutes. So what the heck is taking so long?
The answer is money, that the state really has, it actually has done a pretty good job of getting more than 1,000 acres last year and probably the year before built. But these are very expensive projects, and they take quite a while, and the state has not had the money until now. The state also will be getting money from offshore oil revenue. It gets a tiny amount of money from there now, from federal waters.
What are the consequences if this project doesn't happen or doesn't get fully funded?
The obvious one is that areas south of New Orleans that are not protected by levees today, if no money is put into adding protection to those areas, they're going to have to move or disappear. New Orleans will become more vulnerable to storm surge events. You know, whenever somebody asks me why is New Orleans still here, I point out that When the city was founded in 1718 by Iberville and Bienville, they picked the location that was the closest location to the mouth of the river that was defensible. Then it was defensible against the English. Today it's defensible against storm surge, and that's still the case. The reality is that the city's going to have to be here no matter what. The question is, will it be just a walled city, or will there be an area outside where you have the wetlands as well that support the fisheries of the Gulf of Mexico?
Mark Schlifstein is an environment and hurricane reporter for NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
We talk about tech every week on this show. And today, we're going to examine what's changed in how personal technology allows us to respond to a disaster. To do that, we've got Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Lizzie.
How are you?
I'm well. And I know you're talking about Hurricane Katrina on this show today.
Yep, 10-year anniversary.
It made me realize how long ago that really is when you think about it in internet years.
Mm.
The way that I started to understand the events that were unfolding down there was television.
Mm.
Now, that would be different, right?
Yeah. I mean, television, it seems behind the curve when you're talking about real-time information in 2015.
Right. Twitter, where a lot of us go now to follow and understand real-time breaking news events, hadn't even been invented yet.
Wow.
Facebook had been invented, but it was still limited to students. Cell phones and smartphones certainly existed. They were a lot less useful as tools for both documentation, but also organization.
In terms of organizing information and being able to draw threads from that, I guess? I mean, how has this played out differently if we take a more recent disaster to look at?
So let's look at Superstorm Sandy here in New York City just a couple years ago. FEMA reported that 20 million Sandy-related tweets were sent during the storm. Now, that's going from zero tweets in 2005 to 20 million mostly public data points for people during a disaster like this. And that's even with a lot of people not having power during Sandy or cell service. Another number for you, 10,000 photos were uploaded every second with the Sandy hashtag on Instagram.
I mean, not all of this is necessarily helpful in the middle of a disaster. Some of it is, but I remember some of the chaos and disorganization on the ground in Louisiana when I was there trying to get information. You do have erroneous information circulating.
Absolutely. And Sandy had a lot of misinformation happening here in New York, both in terms of shots of like photoshopped shots of New York subway stations filled with water and scuba divers, but also, you know, after the storm, fake money raising and charity efforts. So it is worth noting that bad information spreads way faster in 2015 than even it did in 2005. And some would argue that isn't really a great development, right?
And yet organizations and even the government do monitor this stuff and pay attention to it. And I would imagine they would say there are strong positives to this.
Yeah, I think they would. I mean, the Red Cross and FEMA could look through those Instagram posts we were talking about before that were geotagged with locations to see what areas were hit the hardest and where they should focus their efforts.
I remember doing a story on the Department of Homeland Security basically having a center where they monitored tweets, and they said, well, it can help us get first responders there faster.
Totally. I mean, social media has become this huge resource for both public and private organizations.
Because of geolocation?
Well, in some instances, yes, but also just in terms of collecting data about what's happening on the ground and sort of crowdsourcing information. I mean, admittedly, yes, some of it will be bad, some of it won't, but I think more information is, in general, a good thing. Now, in 2014, for instance, Facebook introduced a feature called Safety Check that would actually automatically ask people located in a disaster area if they were safe and also notify their friends. I actually spoke to someone who experienced this when they were in the area of the earthquake that hit Nepal recently. And he said that it was really useful to make sure that his family knew that he was okay and for him to also network with people around him. And the key is, of course, that this needs to be good information and also that we need ways to manage it because there's so much more of it now. So I think that that's really important. We're not quite there yet in terms of figuring out how to use all of this information that we're getting, but we're getting a lot more of it. And I think in general, in disaster response, relief efforts, that's a good thing.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
The next stop on our New Orleans bike tour is the Industrial Canal. The canal separates the upper and lower Ninth Wards, and the levees there famously failed in Katrina, flooding the lower Ninth.
We've just jumped off the bikes. We are at the Industrial Canal levee. We're at the end of the bywater, or the end of the upper Ninth Ward. Once we go up the levee here, this grass hill, we're going to be at the Industrial Canal, and you'll be able to look across. You'll be able to see the lower Ninth Ward across from us, and you'll be able to see the river on the right side of us. It's probably the closest thing that kids have to a hill in New Orleans.
Water is both our friend and our enemy in this city. Right on over here, right there, you'll have your occasional alligator. You could fish right off of the rocks right on over there. There's a fisherman coming back right now. I saw the other day somebody come back with probably a 2.5-foot fish. And this, what we're looking at, separates the upper ninth ward where we just were to the lower ninth ward. If somebody told me, if somebody, Jeff from the future, came on up and said, oh, invest in real estate now because this city is going to be booming, I would have said, why are you hustling me, Jeff from the future? I'm not sure what's going to happen in this city. But for good or bad, it's a boom town. Real estate prices where we just biked through have tripled. Somebody put a double shotgun, which is your simple house, up for sale for $1 million. I mean, jaws dropped, but this is a neighborhood that was not like it was before. Nothing against anybody who moves on down. The city is a great place. It is just a changing city. Change can be good. Change can be bad. It just has to be accepted.
You can't think about New Orleans or even smell the air there without being overwhelmed by the importance of food, its history and culture. Restaurants in and around the city employ about 10% of the population by some estimates. And since 1946, Leah Chase has been in the kitchen of the restaurant Dookie Chase's. Quite simply, she's a legend in the city. Her restaurant got 5.5 feet of water in Katrina and closed for 2 years. She's 92 now, and we caught up with her. Where else? The Dookie Chase Kitchen.
Right now, I'm in my kitchen. I get in here about 8 o'clock in the morning. And then I can stand only a limited amount of time. So I will do my cooking. Like this morning, I had to make meatballs and spaghetti and tomato basil soup and red beans and all that. And then after I get it going, then I will sit down and just walk out orders to everybody else, which is hard for me to do because I don't have the patience, you know. Sometimes I get ugly.
I know a lot of people have been asking you about the storm, but I want to know, you had 2 years where Dookie Chase's was closed. Well, what was that like, those 2 years when you were not in your restaurant?
Well, for me, it was misery. For me, it was just moving like a robot every day, just doing what you have to do and not knowing really where you're going. Just going from day to day and hoping for the best. But a lot of people came, honey, to help me clean up. People came from all over this country to help me clean up and to help me get. And I feel so blessed because there are a lot of people my age. I was, what, 83 years old at that time. And that was unbelievable for a person my age to even think about the work I had to do. But I got a lot of faith in God, a lot of faith in myself, and faith in people. And the people helped me, so I'm so blessed to be here.
Did you ever think about not reopening?
No, that never crossed my mind. That's how I know I'm crazy. You know, crazy people don't know what they're doing half the time. You just do it. So I never thought about I couldn't open. That never crossed my mind. I knew that what I could do and what I would try to do. And not only had I bring this restaurant back, I had to bring a whole community back because everything was gone. All my people that were around me, everything was gone. But thank God that I was able to have enough energy to keep it going and to get it going. And now, would you believe, I just got a pacemaker. So I got new energy. My doctor guaranteed me 10 more years, so how about that?
You talk about your community. There are a lot of people wondering about what the fabric of the New Orleans community is like right now. Do you feel a change 10 years out?
There is a change. A change, some of it good, some of it not good. I mean, when I say not good, I mean I lost all of my people that I knew all of my life here. People that helped make me are gone. Some of them are gone for better things. Some of them found better places to live, and things happen for the best all the time. So I stay here and I just work with what I have to work with. But the neighborhoods are coming back, and coming back, honey, totally different. Totally different. We have now more mixed racial mixtures in the neighborhoods. It is unbelievable what's happening in New Orleans here. We have a lot of young people coming, and goodness knows we need them. Young people have vision. Young people have energy. So we need all the young people we can have. And a lot of them are coming back to help us, and we are so grateful.
every single story that is written about you, and it even quotes your son, everything talks about your work ethic. Can you just distill for me what the Leah Chase work ethic is?
My work ethic is, as long as you're living, I was always taught that, as long as you're living, you have to work. It is work not only for yourself, honey. It is work to help other people lift. If you have things going for yourself, you need to help somebody else. You need to lift people up. And that is my work, is to lift people up and to help this whole community going. And I feel like, I don't care, age doesn't matter. If you have the energy, the health, you're supposed to work. You're supposed to work. You're supposed to make a difference. And that's all I try to do, is make a difference.
What has changed the most in your kind of personal economy in the past 10 years? What do you think has been the biggest change for you?
The biggest change, my dear, the people. People have different work ethics now. Sometimes I think they're confused, especially the young people. We have to keep on helping them up because I guess they don't understand a lot of things. Some of them don't understand the many things people did to get them this far and the courage it took so many people. So that's the whole thing, is try to make these young people understand that you have to remember. You don't harp on the past, you remember it and you build on it. So that's what I tried to do. Encourage these young people to go ahead, move ahead. Help us to move ahead. That's the most important thing.
Does that mean staying in New Orleans for them or going somewhere else?
No, they don't have to stay in New Orleans. We want them to stay in New Orleans because we need them. But if they have to move on, they have to move on. But we like them to stay here because we need all these young people here with vision, with energy. We need that. And we're getting a lot of them, so we're grateful.
Leah Chase, it is an honor to speak with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, dear. Thank you.
Gave you a snapshot of the New Orleans economy earlier in the show, and while unemployment is down in the city and back near pre-Katrina levels, that doesn't tell the whole story. We wanted to take a deeper look at what kind of jobs have come back in the last 10 years, and whether you can make a decent living. Amy Liu is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and she researches the economy of New Orleans. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Can you give me kind of an overview of who is working in New Orleans now and how that's different from what it was like 10 years ago?
Well, first of all, the economy has actually improved quite a bit since Katrina and the recession. There are almost as many jobs in the metropolitan area as there were before the storm. But the concern right now are twofold. One is that the bulk of the job growth since the recession in New Orleans has predominantly been in low-wage industries, and therefore we're seeing a lot of workers today with lower wages. In fact, the average annual wages in the New Orleans metropolitan area has declined, and we are seeing a lot more people earning low wages in the economy. In fact, even though the economy and the area has rebounded, there's more poverty today in New Orleans, and there's a higher share of the population that now earns below a living wage to support a family.
I think that in some ways goes against a narrative that we hear a lot around the 10-year anniversary, which is, oh, well, New Orleans has come back and it's rebounded. But it sounds like when you're saying in terms of employment, that's really not the case at all.
Well, I think there's a two-part story to New Orleans today. It has rebounded. The city and the region is nearly the size of the economy and the size of the population is nearly the same. But that recovery is not benefiting people of color, original residents, and particularly lower-income families in the community.
Well, so what kind of jobs are you talking about?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of talk about the job growth, but as I mentioned, the bulk of the job growth in the region has been predominantly in low-wage industries. And so that includes tourism and hospitality, the education sector, primarily because of the shift of a lot of the public school employees into private employment because of the charter school movement, and more retail. And meantime, there have been stagnant job growth or job losses in some of the good-paying industries, such as oil and gas, manufacturing, and finance and insurance.
Well, if somebody came to you and said, you know, I'm 18, I'm not going to get a college degree, but I want to be able to put down real roots, afford a place to live, and maybe have a family, what would you tell them to do?
What I would say first and foremost is that New Orleans is a place that can provide that kind of job opportunity for you. And there are an emerging set of programs and efforts underway in New Orleans to connect young people in school or out of school, even adults, to careers in these good jobs. And so the question is, are we reaching those workers? So Mayor Landrieu, for instance, has a program for summer youth and disconnected youth. The high schools are working with the community colleges around vocational training and career readiness for some of the key sectors in the economy. And the employers are beginning to be more organized in providing opportunities for these young folks. The challenge right now is many of those programs are still new. Many of them are not at scale in terms of serving just a few students at a time. So going forward, what we hope to see in the community is greater attention to this issue so we can reach as many of those workers as possible.
Well, where does that attention have to come from? Does that have to come from a big company, from the mayor? How do you cultivate that?
It's a great question. It certainly takes political leadership to raise the awareness of these issues, the importance of these issues. In many respects, Mayor Landrieu has been a real champion for making sure young people, black males, and others in the community get off the streets, do productive work, and really contribute to the recovery that's underway in the community.
Well, yeah, but your numbers actually seem to tell a different story.
Right. And so to get to that scale, well, we definitely need more employers at the table. This is a big challenge. And I would say it's not just a challenge in New Orleans. In fact, I think in many cities around the country, there's a real desire to figure out how we get this economic recovery to work for more residents. And what's interesting in New Orleans is they're a little bit ahead of the curve in trying to get that done now.
Amy Liu, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Sometimes on this show, we have people tell their own stories about money, what they do to get by, to get ahead, to get noticed. Today, we have a special one from New Orleans, Big Frida, born Freddie Ross. Frida is the queen of bounce music, and it has made her famous with a reality show and an autobiography. But 10 years ago, she was riding out Katrina with her family. Frida took our producer, Jenny Ament, to the church in New Orleans' Third Ward, where she learned to sing. She starts by defining bounce.
You cannot live here and not know what it is and not know how to do one of the moves or something, you know? Birthday parties, weddings, like they got to drop a bounce song and the whole party going to get crunk, you know? That's New Orleans. It's up-tempo, it's heavy bass, it's call and respond. It has a lot to deal with shaking the derriere. I would not say the A word because we're in front of my church, but, you know, of shaking the butt. Gin in my system. I got that gin in my system. Somebody gonna be my victim. Very hilarious. You know my line. You already know. Everybody just falls out for that. Excuse, I don't mean to be rude, but give me that mic. Let me do what I do. You know, just like coming through, like saying how I feel. Let me do what I do, you know, let Frida come through.
Excuse, I don't mean to be rude, but give me that mic, Bud, give me that mic, let Trina come through.
I'm a trendsetter, and I love money, so ideas keep coming to make money, you know? And it gets very complicated because you have so many people that you're trying to feed. More money, more problems. You know, it's so real. I never thought that it would be so many complications at times. You have to learn how to manage your money in this game, especially because you never know when there's going to be a rainy day. I have multi things that I'm into. My music just don't, you know, it reached far and beyond. I'm in, you know, all type of movie placements, and I plan on putting my hands in a lot of other things. You know, I have the reality show as well, working on some spinoff shows, you know, executive producer. Being a black entrepreneur who plans on keep on making business moves and keep on making moves to help people and get them into a different position. I also have my own record company, so plan on putting a few artists under my umbrella and to represent them and represent their music. I have a few things that I can fall back on.
Frida, so dangerous, not dangerous, so dangerous, not Frida, so dangerous, not dangerous. She don't need no help, not.
Katrina definitely brought a lot of us together. It was like a reunion. And a lot of people, Katrina was an advantage for them to even get out the city, and then when they come back, be able to do something new and give them a new breath of life. I've done it, you know, a lot of things in my career thus far, especially within the last 6 years. I have made the music grow so far and get the attention nationally that we deserve for bounce music and the culture of New Orleans.
The Queen D! They want her, she want her, he want her, I got him. They want her, she want her, he want her, I got him. They want her, she want her, he want her, I got him. They want her, she want her, he want her. It go yaka 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 yaka.
Now, one last stop on our New Orleans bike tour with Jeff Scheinman and Leisha Ferguson, who built their small business over the last decade. We're going to end with a look at one of New Orleans' constants.
That White House over there. I lived there for about 4 months, and I dreamed of trains. I woke up thinking about trains, and you'll hear them not just from a block away. You'll hear them from, you know, 5-6 blocks away. About two years ago, a whole bunch of people were complaining about the train and how it's, you know, could stay parked for 8 minutes and things such as that. And I was like, the train has been parked here longer than anybody, longer than I've lived here, longer than most people have who are alive now. The train's been doing this longer than us. The train's got rights. Train called dibs and the train gets dibs.
And the train was here before Katrina, and now it's the same after Katrina every day.
And that's our show for this week. Be sure to let us know about what's changed the most in your post-Katrina economy. You can tell us at marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us at marketplacewknd. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament, who spent the week roaming New Orleans for us, and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer, and Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.